Yes.
So I just want to clarify, which units exactly, what are we responsible for through the quiz?
So the quiz will be pretty much exactly like the homework and pretty much exactly like what we're going to be doing in class today. And it will just involve these, what I would call Q equals MC delta T sort of problems.
Okay.
So not ideal gases, just Q equals MC delta T.
So are we doing the thermal energy stuff today, or is that okay?
Yeah, so we started, but we didn't do any problems last time. More questions? I don't know what the questions are yet. So last time we spent, I don't know, maybe half the time working through the mathematics of an ideal gas. So in an ideal gas, particles can just bounce around. That's the only ability they have. And what we showed is that their kinetic energy was directly proportional to the temperature. So the temperature was a measurement of the internal energy of that gas. And what I argued is that if we had a more complicated situation, if we had something like a solid where energy could be stored in the chemical energy of these springs in addition to the vibration energy, then we would probably find some relationship between the internal energy and the temperature, but it probably wouldn't be a so simple linear relationship that we had with an ideal gas. And what I argued is that if we plotted the internal energy per gram or per mole, we could probably have some sort of roughly linear relationship where more temperature was more internal energy. But when we went through a phase change, there'd be a lot of bonds broken, and so it would take a lot of energy, but it wouldn't change the temperature at all. So here we have at a temperature, say the melting point, a big change in internal energy as we break all of the hydrogen bonds that are required to have ice be in its crystalline form as opposed to in its liquid form. So the slope of this curve of internal energy versus temperature, that's what we call the specific heat or the heat capacity. And since slope is rise over run, the change in internal energy per mass is just going to be the slope times the change in temperature. And so that leads to the equation that we're going to be spending basically all of today on, that the change in internal energy is MC delta T. And we're usually going to call changes in energy Q. I don't know why, but that's what we're going to call it. So we have Q equals MC delta T over there as a fundamental equation. This extra heat that it takes per gram to melt something or to boil something, that's called the latent heat. And that leads to the second equation over there, that Q is equal to the mass times the latent heat. Now, there are lots of these versions of energy that you should be familiar with. So enthalpy is very close to the internal energy.
So what are all those variables? The delta U is obviously the change in internal energy.
Mm-hmm.
What's the C?
So the C is the so-called specific heat, and it's just the slope of internal energy versus temperature. Okay, so enthalpy is very similar to internal energy, except it includes possibilities of pressure and volume. If we have substances that don't change a lot of volume as they undergo a chemical change, then the change in enthalpy will be very similar to the change in internal energy. So technically speaking, if you want to measure a change in internal energy, you have to use a bomb calorimeter where the volume doesn't change, as opposed to kind of normal calorimetry where you do it at constant pressure, in which case you're really measuring changes in enthalpy. So I've labeled this thing internal energy, but probably more commonly it would be the enthalpy. But enthalpy and internal energy are basically the same sorts of thing. And you all should know about Gibbs free energy. It's not going to be topic much in this class. And it's related to the enthalpy and the entropy, which we will be talking about in this class. We talked about the speed distribution. Not all the atoms in this room are moving at the same speed. Some of them are moving very fast, some of them are moving slow. And if we kind of make a plot of the relative number, we have kind of a bell-shaped curve. And this root mean square velocity that we have a formula for is kind of a typical velocity. It's not actually the average velocity or the most common velocity, but it's close enough for our purposes.
Does that say k
Yes.
What does the Z stand for again?
It stands for the famous dead physicist Boltzmann.
B or B?
B. B as in, oh, B. B as in boy. I think Boltzmann's a 2NN. And that Boltzmann is the same as that Boltzmann who did the Maxwell-Boltzmann speed distribution. Oddly enough, Boltzmann committed suicide before he could win his Nobel Prize. It's often said that he committed suicide because it looked like atoms, which were his life work, were not going to be true. But so he kind of committed suicide too early. Say again?
Is that a constant?
Yes. So that's a super important constant, like Newton's gravitational constant.
Where it says U per gram or U per mole?
Yes.
I just don't understand why. Well, you just denote it, or like whether it's per gram or mole or what?
So it could be, so it could happily be either one. So remember, we looked at this chart of specific heats, and you can do your specific heat per gram or per mole. I mean, the basic idea is obviously more material is more internal energy. So we want to divide out the thing that is just bigger depending upon how much we have. And so we could divide out by moles, we could divide out by grams, we could divide out by cc's.
So that'll be told what you want us to do. It's not going to be some crazy, we have to decipher it.
I hope it's not going to be crazy. So kind of historically what you'll see is in this chapter everything's going to be per gram.
Okay. But
you see here that, I mean, there's something special about doing this per mole. These numbers here are much more constant than these numbers here are.
Right.
So, I don't know, maybe in the next chapter, mostly we'll be talking about specific heats per mole, but there isn't any fundamental difference. So instead of having this be mc delta t, this could be nc delta t, where we're talking about the number of moles.
This is sort of unrelated to that, but some of us are having like multiple pages of equations, and on tests, can we have multiple pages with us, or just one?
Just one. Maybe on the final you can have two, but I don't. You can just write small.
What if it's front and back?
No, one side is enough, I claim. Yes.
And then when it becomes N, it just transfers to moles then? Or how does that work?
So it's a matter of what the specific heat is. So if you have been given the specific heat per gram, then that's the one you want to use. If you've been given the specific heat per mole, you want to use that. So basically we're just multiplying this by something that says how much we have. And they might have told you it in moles, and they might have told you it in grams, they might have told you it in cc's.
Yep.
All sorts of possibilities.
So, on quizzes and exams, would you be giving us things where it's like, you give us a specific heat in grams, but then you give us moles of the product? Or, so then we have to
yeah.
Do like...
So I can imagine that at some point I'll have you... Mostly no. How's that for an answer? I could imagine having you do that sort of conversion, but I'm not sure why I would have you do that.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, you'd probably need a periodic table to do the conversion, so I'm not thinking that you can write the periodic table so small that you can fit it onto your cheat sheet.
I've got, yeah, we've got to memorize it. So.
Good.
Is C in calories then? Or what are the units in all of these? Or for like the U, what is the, for...
Yeah, what's your favorite unit? So you'll see it both ways. And I think what I've decided to do is to do everything in joules.
Okay.
But some of the book's problems are in calories, just as some of the book's problems are in miles per hour. So I would say that calories are pretty obsolete, that for a century we've known that there's an exact conversion to joules, so why not use it?
Okay.
And the reason why not, incidentally, is that the specific heat of water kind of defined a calorie. So I know what the specific heat of water is. It's one calorie per gram degree. And if you had asked me what the specific heat of water was 2 weeks ago, I probably wouldn't have been so sure. So just as the density of water being one, the specific heat of water being one using calories is nice. And I'm sure you're going to do this all again in chemistry if you haven't already, so I'm not sure what they're going to use. What have you've talked about enthalpies. Have they been in joules or calories? Yeah, okay, it'll be in joules then. More questions? Okay, so we got some cold stuff here. So that's liquid nitrogen. How cold is it? You missed it. Tasty.
How do you not freeze yourself?
It's called the Leidenfrost effect. So if I stick my finger in there and swirl it around, it's not good for the finger. But if I just let it bounce off the surface, there's only a limited amount of heat transfer. So I want you to cup it in your hand carefully and let it soak in. It feels cold, right?
A little bit.
And maybe a kind of a little bit wet, but it doesn't hurt. But obviously, obviously if you stuck your finger in there, it would freeze, right? I know, so somebody recently died by drinking liquid nitrogen.
Yeah, you should try it. No, I'm kidding.
Okay, so I'm kind of giving you a typical sort of problem that you might have with calorimetry. But maybe before that, we should talk a little bit about temperature measurement. So how am I going to get the temperature of this liquid nitrogen? Because it's pretty cold, right? So you could use these kind of typical thermometers where we've talked about how they work by volume expansion. The volume is pushed up the capillary and you just put marks on the side to say what the volume increase was. But I hope you know that mercury and alcohol are solid at liquid nitrogen temperature, so that's not going to work. But what we have are various electronic ways of measuring temperature. So this is a platinum resistance thermometer. It actually defines temperature between, I don't know, the boiling point of hydrogen and the melting point of platinum. And it kind of makes you burp after you eat a lot of it. So what you can see is that the temperature is roughly speaking about minus 200 in that liquid nitrogen. So that's 70 degrees or so above absolute zero.
And that's in Celsius, correct?
Yeah, this is in Celsius. And I don't even have the option of pushing it to Fahrenheit. Why would one want to? So platinum resistance thermometers are one common way of measuring temperature. Another common way of measuring temperature is with what's called a thermocouple. So here we have just two dissimilar metals which are just soldered together, and there's a voltage difference that is produced that's related to the temperature, and you can pretty much immediately read the temperature off. It's on a big scale. So I take it it's going up because I am alive, I think. So kind of a typical sort of experiment, we might be interested in the latent heat of vaporization of the liquid nitrogen. So currently this thing is boiling because, of course, heat is leaking in through this Dewar. But if I add more heat, I'm going to get more boiling of the liquid nitrogen. So if I take something that's boiling hot, like this piece of aluminum that's at room temperature, and I put it in this nitrogen, I get a certain amount of mass that is boiled off as amount of heat is transferred from that piece of aluminum to the liquid nitrogen. And this thing is sitting on a scale so I can measure how much nitrogen was boiled off in this process. Now, this is pretty clearly a non-equilibrium process, right? There are huge temperature differences between the aluminum and the nitrogen, but none of that really matters. The only thing that matters is the final state of the system. So if we wait long enough, this thing is still boiling pretty vigorously. If we wait long enough, then we'll have the aluminum and the nitrogen all at the boiling point of liquid nitrogen, right? Roughly minus 200 or so. And I don't know, I'm getting bored, but if I wanted to know how much heat the aluminum gave up in going from room temperature to liquid nitrogen temperature, I could just do the reverse. I could take this cold piece of aluminum and I could stick it in water, and what's going to happen is, again, a very non-equilibrium situation. Ice is being created on the surface of this aluminum, but all of the heat that this thing gave up in boiling the liquid nitrogen is going to be eaten. It's going to eat that same amount of energy from the water. And so as a result, the temperature of the water is going to go down. So by looking at how much the temperature of the water was reduced, we could figure out how much energy it took to boil the nitrogen, and we could figure out then what the heat of vaporization of the nitrogen was.
You said something like that it's going to hit equilibrium with the temperature of the nitrogen. Why doesn't it come together, like, and meet in the middle? Like, how come it...
Well, so just as you can't have liquid water at 250 degrees Fahrenheit, you can't have liquid nitrogen that's at halfway between. So if we're going to have liquid nitrogen, it's going to be at minus 200, period. It can be colder than that, just as you can have water that's below 212 Fahrenheit, but it can't be warmer than that and still be liquid. So heat of vaporization is an example of latent heat. So latent heats occur at any phase transition. So the amount of energy it takes to melt ice, that would be a latent heat. The amount of energy it takes to boil water, that would be a latent heat. So any of these extra amounts of energy that it takes in order to change phase, that's what we mean by a latent heat. So I've got kind of a sleazy demonstration to show you this relationship between temperature and state. Well, everyone in the last class got excited, so maybe I should say cheesy as opposed to sleazy. Anything good happening? So what we want to see here is kind of what's the relationship between temperature and phase change and all of these sorts of things. So here we have water. I take it you can see the Mickey Mouse H2O, the red oxygens, the white hydrogens, in a lattice that represents the solid phase of ice. It's vibrating around because it has some temperature, and so it has some amount of kinetic energies, but things are staying pretty much in place. If I increase the temperature, I can melt that ice. So now I have stuff that's staying on the bottom, but the neighbors are not exactly fixed. Things are moving around with time. So that transition from a static but vibrating lattice to a crowd that is jostling each other, that's the transition between going between a liquid and a solid. And you can see there's more kinetic energy now than there was. If I heat it up more, we've got more kinetic energy, but the atoms are still staying on the bottom of the container. Now you know that there's this process of vapor pressure, so that some of the water will be floating above as water vapor above the liquid surface. The higher the temperature, the larger the fraction of the water that is flying around as a vapor as opposed to sitting on the bottom in liquid state. If I go to higher temperatures yet, I can evaporate all of that water, and now we have kind of the ideal gas situation where we have molecules that are bouncing around. making elastic collisions with the wall, which is causing the pressure. If I increase the temperature still more, I can disassociate the hydrogen atoms from the oxygen atoms, and we start to have a plasma state where we have ionized gas, where the atoms are broken apart into their constituent particles, nuclei and electrons, at the highest available temperature. Okay, so we've got slowly vibrating lattices. We've got liquids that are hanging around the bottom with maybe some atoms floating above as vapor pressure. We've got free-flying atoms, and finally we have an ionized gas, all just depending upon the temperature that's involved.
Do you know how hot the plasma phase is, like where the specific heat, the latent heat is for plasma, not for water?
So no, I don't know what it is. I also don't know what the temperature is. It's going to depend on the pressure. Just as actually the boiling point depends on the pressure, but it's not a whole lot for liquid and solid water. So you all know that water and every substance boils and melts at different temperatures depending upon the pressure. Don't know that number. More questions? Okay, so let's take a look at some of the problems. So, start out, we've got a 1.5 kilogram iron horseshoe that's at 600 C, and it has a certain amount of energy. And we've got a bucket of water, which 20 kilograms of water, which is at 25 C. It also has a certain amount of energy. That energy is going to be conserved. So whatever we have initially, we're going to have the same amount of energy finally. But what's going to happen is a lot of the energy that's in the iron is going to be transferred to the water, so that the water is going to increase in temperature. So the water is going to gain energy, the iron is going to lose energy, but the total amount of energy is going to be unchanged in this process. So how can we calculate these changes in energy? Well, according to our equation, Q equals mc delta T. So the iron is going to lose an amount of energy that we can calculate. It's going to be the mass of iron times the specific heat of iron times the change in temperature. So we don't know what temperature it's going to end up at, but we know it started at 600. And the temperature is going to be lower than 600, so this is going to be a negative quantity. The iron is going to have lost energy. On the other hand, the water times the specific heat of water, it's going to have started at 25 degrees Celsius, and it's going to end up at some temperature T. So negative heat here from the iron, it's going to have lost energy. Positive heat is going to the water. But the total amount of energy change is zero because we've got conservation of water. Excuse me, we've got conservation of energy. So how do we get these numbers, right? We also have conservation of water too, I guess. So we can look up the specific heats, and here's the specific heat of iron. It's 448, and the specific heat of water, 4186. I think I used 4 before. So we have, how much? It was 1.5 kilograms of water, of iron, and the specific heat we said is 448. Say again?
What's the units on that? Is that
joules? 1 second on the units. Let me finish writing this. It was 20 kilograms of water, and 4186 is the specific heat of water. T minus 25 equals zero. So the units. So the units are up for grabs. You could use calories per gram degree, or you can use joules per kilogram degree. And works the same either way. This is just unit conversion, whether we decide to measure energy in calories or joules. And I think I've decided everything I'm going to do today is going to be in joules. So, but your mileage may vary. Okay, so the iron loses energy. The water gains energy. Those changes in energy are accompanied by changes in temperature. And we've got one equation and one unknown. So if we want to find the final temperature, all we have to do is do the calculation. So let's put together all of the terms that have a T in it. And I think I'm going to switch back to letters as opposed to numbers. So what we have is the mass of the iron, the specific heat of the iron, that's this term here. And we've got the mass of water and the specific heat of water, that's this term here. All of those are times temperature. And then we've got the negative terms. This one here, we've got the mass of the iron times the specific heat of the iron times the initial temperature, which was 600. And here we've got the mass of water times the specific heat of water times its initial temperature, which was 25. And there's still no net energy transfer. So it all has to add up to zero. If I put the negative term on the other side of the equation, so that's the mass of iron, specific heat of iron, the mass of water, the specific heat of water, all that times temperature has to equal all of this stuff. The mass of iron, the specific heat of iron, the initial temperature, plus the mass of water times the specific heat of water times its initial temperature. And so finally, if I divide through, the temperature is going to equal the mass of iron, specific heat of iron, the 600 degrees, the mass of water, the specific heat of water, times the 25 degrees, divided by very similar stuff that just lacks the initial temperatures. Now, in working these problems, it's smart if you can kind of get some sort of estimate of what the right answer is before you plug and chug. And I don't know exactly what the right answer is, but it's got to be more than the temperature it started with, right? I dropped a red-hot piece of iron into it. So I'm looking for a temperature that is certainly more than 25 degrees. And, I don't know, we can see if we get it. So the mass of iron was 1.5. The specific heat was 448. And the mass of water was 20, and the specific heat of water was 4186. Okay, so plug and chug. 1.5 and the 448 and the 600 and the 20 and the 4186 and the 25. And I'm supposed to divide that all by the 1.5 and the 448 and the 20 and the 4186. And what I get is 29.6 degrees Celsius. So I could have done this all in Kelvin, but it would have been, no, I would have had to have changed both of these things into Kelvin. It would have worked the same way.
How do we know there was no net loss of or transfer of energy?
Because energy is conserved. Right? So energy isn't used up. Okay, so in this particular problem, we have some probably approximations. If you dump this horseshoe in, there's probably going to be a lot of water vapor that's produced. We've ignored that. The thing is in a container, which is also going to change in temperature, so there's going to be some contribution to that. So here we have a slightly more realistic thing. We at least have a container. So we have a half kilogram container, which is at 20 degrees Celsius. We've got 6 kilograms of ethyl alcohol that's at 30 degrees, and we've got 1 kilogram of ice that is at minus 10 C. And we're basically supposed to figure out what the final temperature is when we mix all of these things together. Okay, so you know what's going to happen is that energy from the hot stuff is going to flow into the cold stuff, but the total amount of energy change is going to be zero because energy is conserved. So if we start writing down all of these things, so we've got the mass of aluminum times the specific heat of aluminum. We don't know what the final temperature is, but the aluminum started at 20 degrees Celsius. It's probably going to be colder afterwards, so we're going to get a negative contribution. Energy is going to be lost from the aluminum. And then we've got the mass of the ethyl alcohol times the specific heat of the ethyl alcohol. It started at 30 degrees, and it's going to end up at the temperature that we're trying to calculate. So do notice this is always final minus initial. Now, the ice is a little bit trickier because it's going to melt, and so we have to include its latent heat of fusion in addition to its temperature change. So we have to go through this in steps. We have the mass of ice times the specific heat of ice, and what's going to happen is that ice is going to go from minus 10 to 0 degrees. When it's at its melting point, it can melt, and then we're going to release an amount of heat that's equal to the latent heat of fusion times the mass of ice. So at this point, we have what was ice and is now liquid water. This once ice, now water, is going to go from 0 degrees Celsius to the final temperature T.
Mm-hmm. What is the M times L? Where does that come into play?
So this is the energy that it took to melt the ice.
Oh, and you add all of those together.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So the ice is going to gain energy as we put all of this energy into it. It's going to go to 0 degrees, it's going to melt, and it's going to end up as water at some temperature T. All of those steps took positive energy. All of that energy is coming from them. But the latent heat of fusion?
I thought C was latent heat.
No, C is specific heat. So specific heat is the slope, and latent heat are these jumps that it takes to change phase.
Does the top line say 0 equal to 10?
Nah, so it says minus a minus 10. Because it started at minus 10. So the sum of all of these heats has to be zero. So if we play the same game, if we put together all of the terms that depend on temperature, so what we're going to have then is the mass of aluminum times the specific heat of aluminum, that's this term here, plus the mass of ethyl alcohol times the specific heat of ethyl alcohol. That's this term here. And kind of surprisingly, we've got the mass of the ice, which became water, and since we want the specific heat of water, all of that is multiplied by T. Yes?
For me, I don't understand doing it that way as much. So if you were to just take the mass and specific heat and just multiply it by the T, and multiply the terms through, would that also be a way of doing it?
So it's all algebra.
Yeah,
so you can multiply all of these things out,
and
then you can put the T terms together. That
makes more sense for me,
so. Okay. Yeah, so I guess I'm just doing these things in pieces. So now I'm going to deal with all of these negative terms. So I've got the mass of aluminum times the specific heat of aluminum times this 20. And here I've got the mass of the ethyl alcohol times the specific heat of the ethyl alcohol times that 30. And here I've got the mass of the ice times the specific heat of ice times minus 10. And I have one remaining term plus the mass of ice times the latent heat of ice. All that has to add up to zero. So we've put everything that doesn't have a T on it on the other side of the equation. This term is going to be positive on the other side. So we have mass of aluminum, specific heat of aluminum, 20. Mass of ethyl alcohol, specific heat of ethyl alcohol, times 30. Plus, this is actually a negative number, the mass of the ice times the specific heat of ice times its initial temperature, which is minus 10. And we have minus the mass of ice times the latent heat of fusion. And all that is going to be divided by this thing here in order to give us the final temperature. So we've got the mass of aluminum, the specific heat of aluminum, the mass of ethyl alcohol times the specific heat of ethyl alcohol, kind of surprisingly, the mass of the ice times the specific heat of water. This minus 10? This one. Because this was plus on this side of the equation. So when I bring it to the other side of the equation, it's going to be a minus. And it was plus on this side of the equation because you had to add heat to the ice to melt it. Okay, so the mass of the aluminum is half a kilogram. The mass of the ice is 1 kilogram. The mass of the ethyl alcohol is 6 kilograms. And then we need to look up our specific heats and latent heats for that matter. So we need the specific heat of ethyl alcohol, 2430. And we've had the specific heat of water before, right? 4186. We've got that one. The specific heat of aluminum is 900. Now the latent heat of, those are all kind of moderate numbers. The latent heat of fusion of ice is 3.3 times 10 to the fifth. So that's a pretty big number. And all of these units have been in joules per kilogram. Yes?
Is fusion then, like if you're doing a state from solid to liquid?
Yes. And it, if you were freezing it, you'd still use that number except with a minus sign.
Okay.
More questions? Okay, well, there's a lot to plug and chug.
What was the specific heat of ice?
Ah, thank you. 2090, I think I remember from the previous class. 2090. Okay, so I got 0.5 times 900 times the 20 degrees Celsius that it started with. And I've got the 6 kilograms times the 2430 times the 30 degrees that it started with. Add that in. And I've got the 2090 times 10 and subtracted from all of that. And I'm also supposed to subtract the mass of ice, which is 1, times 3.33 nr exponent 5. So I don't know if I did this right or not, but the numerator I've got here is 9.25 times 10 to the fourth.
Is the latent heat of fusion a constant?
Yes.
So
all of these numbers are, okay, when I say it's a constant, I guess I have to be a little bit careful. So just as the density of water isn't literally a constant, it varies a little bit with temperature, all of these things vary a little bit with temperature and pressure. So in terms of this class, you can assume they're a constant. But in fact, they do vary.
It'll be 3.23 times 10.
Yes, as long as it's water, right? If we're freezing aluminum or something, then it'll be a different number.
That's the
amount of energy it takes to melt 1 kilogram of water.
And I can find that in the table.
You can find that in the table.
Okay.
So a different amount to melt 1 kilogram of iron, but it's also in the table. Okay, so how about the numerator? So I've got the mass of aluminum, which is 0.5, and the 900. And I've got the mass of ethyl alcohol, which is 6 times the 2430. And I've got the mass of the ice, which is 1 times the 4186. And for my numerator, I get 1.92 times 10 to the 4th. And I get 4.8 degrees. It's what I got the first time, too. Questions? Now, there's one thing that is... Question? It's on the... Okay.
So all of these cases have been equal zero, where all energy is conserved.
Yes.
Would an example of a problem where energy isn't conserved if that water boiled out?
No, it's conserved. It's just that energy went into boiling the water. So there would be a latent heat of vaporization for the water. So if we wanted to... So if you're saying if we didn't know how much heat was lost.
Yeah, I guess, like, is there ever a case where Q doesn't equal zero, like that we will be covering?
So I think there is a case, but it's not a case that I don't think you'll be confused by. So we'll work some problems about kinetic energy of a car being converted into the temperature of your brakes. So there's a definite amount of energy that went in the form of kinetic energy. And then we can figure out what the temperature change is. But energy is always conserved if we add up all the amounts.
Okay. So where it says mass of ice times the latent heat of fusion, the reason that's positive is because the overall...
Here it's negative, though, right? Yeah, that's the same as this one.
Okay, regardless. So that's positive because we're getting warmer in terms of the water.
Well, yeah. So I would say it's positive because we're going from solid to liquid. Yeah. If we were doing the reverse, then it would be negative.
Okay, that's what I guess. All right, just making sure.
Yeah, so if you look in the book, they'll say that the heat lost is plus or minus M times L according to whether you're, you know, for example, boiling water as opposed to condensing water, melting water as opposed to freezing water. More questions? Okay, so this is kind of a similar problem, except we've made the ice even colder. So now we have a block of ice that's at minus 78, so basically the temperature of dry ice. And we're going to drop that ice into basically half a kilogram of water and an 80 gram copper calorimeter, and we're going to determine the final temperature. So these problems all should look pretty much the same, right? It's MC delta T of everything, where it's always delta T is final minus initial. If there's been a phase change, then we're going to have a latent heat of vaporization or fusion with a corresponding mass, and a sign according to whether heat was added or subtracted from the system, right? Whether we boiled water or whether we condensed water. So in this particular case, we've got the... Might as well square it up a little bit. We've got the water and the calorimeter that is at 25 degrees C, and it's going to be cooled by putting this ice in it. So we've got 0.5 kilograms of water. Specific heat of water is 4186. We don't know the final temperature, but we know that it started at 25 C. We've got a 80 gram copper calorimeter times the specific heat of copper, which we'll have to look up in a second. And it also started at 25. The ice, 40 grams of it, and we've looked up its specific heat, it's 2090. It started at minus 78, and it's going to end up as liquid water, it's going to end up at just below the melting point at 0 degrees. Then we're going to melt that ice, which takes 3.33 times 10 to the fifth joules per kilogram. Then we have liquid water, same amount, and we're going to increase its temperature from 0 degrees to the unknown final temperature, T. So this is, T is going to be less than 25. So this is all negative quantity. This is heat that was given up by the water and the calorimeter. And these are all positive quantities. These are heats that were gained by the ice. First of all, getting it to the melting point, then melting it, and then increasing it in temperature to T. Energy lost, energy gained, but the total change in energy has to be zero because energy is conserved.
Both of those two terms are being added, right?
Yes. So we need the specific heat of copper. So it's kind of exactly the same story, I guess. You can expand all of these things out if you want. My favorite way is to put together all of the terms that have the unknown in them. So I'm going to have the mass of water times the specific heat of water plus the mass of copper times the specific heat of copper plus the mass of what was once ice times the specific heat of water, all of that times T. Then I've got all of these negative terms that come from the initial temperatures. So that's the water times its specific heat times this initial temperature, and the copper times its specific heat times its initial temperature. And then we've got the ice, 40 grams of ice, its specific heat, and its initial temperature, which is negative. Then we have the energy it takes to melt the ice, and the sum of all of those terms has to be zero. Question? Good. Okay, so we could plug and chug. I'm not sure I want to risk making a mistake. I can tell you that the answer I came up with was, which number is this? Is this 31? 15.5. You mean why is this zero here? So we're dealing with ice, and the first thing we did is raise it from this cold temperature to its melting point. Then we melted it, and so then we had liquid water at 0 degrees. So this is the liquid water going from 0 degrees to T. So we're just going through the steps that once ice went through. So if you think about it, if we change the problem a little bit, if I have more and more ice, then eventually it won't all melt. how would I know I was in that situation, right? So this problem said that it all melted, but if the problem didn't say that, what would be the clue that something's wrong? And the answer is you'd get a negative number for T. Right? You can't have liquid water at -1 degree or something like that. So that means that your assumption was wrong. And that this liquid water transformation never happened. If we have ice that's floating in water, then we know what the final temperature is. It has to be zero. But we don't know how much mass melted. So if we assume that some of the ice melted, we could calculate the mass m that melted. The only way we can have water and ice in equilibrium is if the temperature is zero. And same thing with steam and water has to be at 100 degrees Celsius. So if two states are simultaneously present, we have to be at the melting point, boiling point of that system. Well, if you think about it, if I have enough ice, then maybe the ice isn't even going to reach the melting point. Maybe the ice is going to end up at -10 and never get a chance to melt at all. What would be the tip-off that that's the case? Well, if we calculate a negative number for M, then that means that instead of having anything melt, we had stuff that went from the liquid stage to the solid stage.
How would we see it?
So can you, just stopping to make some, could you go, like, if temperature is at a negative, that means what? If it's at zero, that means what?
So let me give you the main upshot of this first. So first of all, in cases where we have changes in state, there are often lots of possibilities. And what we have to recognize is what's possible. And if we get an answer that is impossible, then we were wrong and we have to try another possibility. So if we have lots of ice and we do this calculation, we're going to get a negative value for this temperature. And you can see that because this number is being multiplied by a negative number. So on the other side, the bigger that number is, the lower the temperature is going to be. And if I have enough ice to start with, then this calculated temperature is going to be less than zero, which is not possible. So that's the tip-off that my calculation was incorrect. So another possibility is that some of the ice melted, but not all of it. So that I have some water and some ice. In that circumstance, I know that the temperature has to be zero. I know that there's not this term, because this term had to do with that once ice getting up to temperature T. But what I don't know is what amount of that mass melted. So now I could calculate the amount of mass that melted. If I get a negative number for that, then that's a tip-off that the ice didn't all melt. But it's not a tip-off that we're wrong. What that's going to mean is some of this ice froze. If this number gets as big as -0.56, then we're in an impossible situation. There's only 0.56 of this stuff to become solid. So then we're in the situation that we're back to the piece of iron. Right? We don't have any of these terms. We just have some final temperature, T, which is going, oops, I think I lied for a minute, but let me continue. We then have some temperature, T, which is going to be negative. Okay, so the lie I made is that in that circumstance, all of this mass is going to have frozen. So I have to have that term too.
So if you find M and it's a negative, that means that another substance, like from a different water substance, froze.
Yes.
In state. Okay.
Yes. And the bottom line is if you make a calculation and you get an impossible result, it's impossible, right? It has to be a different physical situation.
Or you discovered a new law of physics.
Yeah, or you've hit a wrong button on your calculator. Multiple choice question, I guess.
Do you have to change
So we've talked about lots of different situations, so I'm not sure which one you're in.
But some froze.
So if some of this ice froze or melted, or if some of this ice. So let me phrase it differently. The three possible final states are all water, some ice and water, and just ice. In the middle case, if there's some ice and some water, then we know the final temperature, and what we could do is calculate how much ice there is. If this number is more negative than minus 5.6, it's not possible, right? We couldn't have converted more than that amount. If that number is more positive than 0.04, we're in an impossible situation. There wasn't more than 0.04 ice to melt.
So, first thing you'd want to do is see if T comes out negative. If T comes out negative, then you want to solve for mass, right? And if mass is bigger than 0.56, then you know you're...
Yeah, so the order doesn't matter, right? So you're going to make a guess of what the final state is, and if you get an impossible answer, then you're going to go on to the next possibility. So in this case here, there wasn't that much ice, so it's pretty obvious that it's going to melt. But if I say, you know, I put a frozen elephant into, you know, a hundred milliliters of water that was at 1 degree Celsius, hard to do, but you might try and do it. Then it's pretty clear that it's not going to all melt, right? So sometimes you can look at the initial situation and see whether it makes sense. But make a guess. If you get an impossible answer, go on to the next possibility. Well, let's do this automobile problem because I don't think it'll take much time, and it's the one that's a little bit different. So this is the case where we do have extra energy, right? So we are going to be converting the kinetic energy of this car into the internal energy of the brakes. And of course, what's going to happen is the brakes are going to get hotter as that kinetic energy is dumped in the form of heat. And the question that they're asking is, how many times can we hit the brakes before the brakes literally melt? Okay, so the kinetic energy of the car, that's 1/2 mv². The car weighs 1.5 metric tons, and it's moving at 25 meters a second. So we can calculate the heat that is produced every time we stop the car. And the answer is about 4.7 times 10 to the fifth joules. And we can calculate how much heat it would take to melt aluminum. Well, not to melt aluminum, to get it to its melting point. So we need to know what the melting point of aluminum is. And if we go to this table, it gives us heats of fusion and heats of vaporization. It also gives us the temperature at which they occur. And for aluminum, the melting point is 660 C. So if we've got 6 kilograms of aluminum, so 6 kilograms of aluminum, and the specific heat of aluminum is 900. And we're going to end up at 660, and we started at 20. That's the amount of energy it's going to take in order to reach the melting point of the aluminum. And this is basically 3.5 times 10 to the 6. So roughly speaking, 10 times more energy to melt the brakes than to stop it once. So to get the exact number of times, we need to see how many times this goes into that. So we have the 3.5 times 10 to the 6 joules divided by the 4.7 times 10 to the 5th joules. And basically get 7.4 times. number of times. Number of times you can hit the brakes. Each time you hit the brake, you use up basically 500,000 joules, and it takes 3.5 million joules in order to melt your brakes.
So is this scenario like continuously hitting your brakes, or how?
Yeah, so this is you're going 25 miles an hour, you hit the brakes, come to a dead stop, you accelerate to 25 miles an hour, hit your brakes, come to a dead stop. So you can do that 7.4 times before your brakes melt. Now, realistically, this isn't what happens, right? What happens is the hydraulic fluid that controls the brakes boils, and then your brakes become ineffective. So you just hit trees as opposed to melting aluminum.
That's useful.
How did you know to use the kinetic energy equation? Like, what the problem set it off to for you to know how to use that?
Well, so what there's, I guess I'd have to look at the exact words, but that's what's happening, right? We have some kinetic energy, and it's going to be conserved. It's going to go someplace when I hit the brakes. And what it's going to end up as is the internal energy of the aluminum.
Okay.
So I don't know if I answered your question or not. More questions? Well, let's take a look at one more Q equals MC delta T sort of problems. This one here is a little bit different. As opposed to finding a final temperature, we're supposed to look at this as an experimental result in order to find the specific heat of aluminum. So we start with water and calorimeter at 70 degrees, and we put in a hunk of aluminum that initially has a temperature of 27 degrees. So they're going to reach some equilibrium temperature that is, roughly halfway between 66 degrees as this heat is used to heat up this aluminum. So there's no phase change here. It's pure Q equals MC delta T, with the unknown being the specific heat of aluminum as opposed to the final temperature. So we've got 0.4 kilograms of water, and we know it's 4186 joules per kilogram degree. We started out at 70, and we ended up at 66.3. So we got a negative number because heat is leaving the water and going into the aluminum. We've got the calorimeter itself, which weighs 0.04 kilograms and has a specific heat of, I don't know why they did this. So you notice that that's kilojoules. So we have to multiply that by 1,000, right? So it's really 630 joules per kilogram degree Celsius, times its change in temperature, which is exactly the same as the water. It started out at 70, and it's going to go to 66.3. So again, energy is being lost from the calorimeter. All of this lost energy is going into the aluminum. And what we have is 0.2 kilograms of aluminum with an unknown specific heat. And it's going to go from its initial temperature of 27 to the final temperature of 66. And the sum of all of these heats has to be zero. Negative heats from the water, positive heats from the aluminum, one unknown, namely the specific heat. So, I don't know, maybe this is even a little bit easier. If I take all of this stuff here, which was all negative where it stands, and I put it on the other side of the equation, I've got 0.2 times C times its temperature change is equal to all of this stuff with a minus sign in front of it, but it's all negative already, so. And of course, I can divide all of this stuff through, and I can calculate the specific heat. So if I run the numbers, notice that this is a common term, so I only have to calculate that once. So I've got the 70 and the 66.3. And then I've got the 0.4 and the 4186 and the 0.04 and the 630. And then I've got the 66.3 and the 27. And what I get is basically 800 joules per kilogram degree Celsius, which is not super accurate. So this is what the claim, the actual specific heat is. Say again? Yeah, that's what we were calculating. That's what this experiment, this made-up experiment, was supposed to be finding.
So what exactly went wrong that it doesn't match?
So I think it's, you know, experimental error, right? So we actually need the uncertainty in all of those quantities. It's not terrible, right? It's roughly 10% off. Okay, so quiz next time on this sort of stuff, MC delta T, latent heats. Then on to the next chapter. Oh, what? I got 2 minutes, right? So, other toys. You've seen these sorts of toys before, I take it? So.
Yeah, like Christmas ornaments and stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, it's the heat in your hands.
That does what?
That's making it go up.
Kind of like levitates it?
Yeah.
Levitation.
It's the heat of the air.
So, yeah, so I'm changing the temperature of the fluid, which changes its vapor pressure, which then pushes it up to the top.
But why does it just stay there?
It won't over time. It'll go back down.
So if you turn it over and hold the other side, will it do it?
So I can do this to speed it up. So we talked about ways of measuring temperature at kind of moderate temperatures. This is kind of a fun one. Everything that has a temperature is producing light. So even though if you can't see it, these walls are producing infrared light. And the amount of the light depends on the temperature. The hotter something is, the more infrared light it's producing. So this thing measures that infrared and reports that the temperature of that wall is 19 degrees Celsius, right? So no contact, right? Zero?
It must be that liquid nitrogen. It's the liquid nitrogen.
So it goes negative, but there's more, there's a lot of wall that's there before it hits the nitrogen. So it's more measuring the temperature of the wall than it is of the nitrogen. So it's going to minus 47 now. But there's a lot of surface that it's looking at that isn't at nitrogen temperature. You can be.
It's so cool. No, it really doesn't.
So
just make sure you tilt your hand.
Yeah, do tilt your hand. That doesn't have to be a whole lot. It's cold, but a little bit wet.
So what happens if you put it in your hand and you swirl it? Does it still make enough contact to?
Well, you can do that for a while, but. I mean, obviously, if you put your finger in there,
just stick it in there, yeah.
It's going to be, I mean, you can do that for a second. But if you leave it in there, just as you can put your finger in your refrigerator for a while, it's not, no, I don't want to cause damage.
I have a question.
Let's go over here.
You have to kind of wrap your hand around it.
Still doesn't
work. Oh. I just wanted to like clarify this. So this was the
Literally, your hands are freezing.
Was this the MC term? And then this was the ML.